Hello, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Eric Siegel, chair of the club's Personal Growth Forum. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. Our speaker is Dr. Marty Klein, a licensed marriage and family therapist and certified sex therapist in Palo Alto for 35 years. He is the award-winning author of 7 books about sexuality, including America's War on Sex, Sexual Intelligence, and the new His Porn, Her Pain, as well as the DVD Enhancing Porn Literacy in Young People. You can purchase all of these after Marty's talk, and you may also want to visit his blog at www.sexed.org. Marty is an internationally respected expert regarding pornography who appears frequently in the national media, including The New Yorker, The New York Times, National Public Radio, and The Daily Show. A founding editorial board member of the Journal of Porn Studies, Marty contributed to the pornography section of the International Encyclopedia of Human Sexuality and testifies on the subject in state, federal, and international courts. He recently gave 2 congressional briefings on evidence-based sex education. Each year, Marty speaks to tens of thousands of physicians, psychologists, lawyers, and lay people across North America and Europe. His talks are known to be down-to-earth, thought-provoking, and entertaining, and that's why we've invited him back to speak to us again, this time about the intersection of pornography and the Internet. Marty will discuss the context of our difficulties with pornography and will then talk about how to build what he calls porn literacy, both in children, in couples, and in porn consumers, while discussing the scientific evidence about how sexually explicit material actually affects consumers, their relationships, and society. It's now my pleasure to ask you to join me in welcoming to the Commonwealth Club of California our speaker, Dr. Marty Klein.
Thank you, Eric. It's a pleasure to be back at the Commonwealth Club, America's foremost public policy forum. At least that's what I tell people. I'm very glad to be here. We have about 45 or 50 minutes of a little presentation, and then we'll have a few minutes for questions. And this talk actually starts back in 1999. Back in 1999, Labor Day weekend, back in 1999, if we were all sitting around, say, in Eric's backyard, having a nice glass of Zinfandel, and one of you might have said, you know, what do you suppose would happen if the country were flooded with free 24/7 pornography? And if one of you had asked that question, we would have had a fun time speculating what would have happened. Would there be a big jump in the amount of divorce? Would everybody lose weight to look like porn stars? Would there be a big spike in child molestation? Would everybody leave the country for Canada? What would happen if the country were flooded with free 24/7 porn? If we had asked that question during the Labor Day weekend back in 1999, that would have been interesting. And just a few months later, we would have seen the beginning of the answer, because that's just about when broadband came to America, and suddenly America was flooded with high-quality, free, 24/7 porn. And so for the last 16 years, we've been engaged in a very interesting social experiment. What do you suppose would happen if the country were flooded with porn? And now we actually know. And that's what we're going to talk about today. Now, as a sex therapist, I'm in Palo Alto. I've been on the same address 30 years. As a sex therapist, I see people who are in genuine pain about pornography every week, every month, every year. And here's what people say. People say, I watch more than I intend to watch, and I feel inadequate compared to pornography. I want to have a partner with a perfect body, and I know my partner doesn't like the fact that I watch, and I hate keeping secrets. And so people talk to me a lot about the pain that they're in. And then the partners of consumers they're also in a lot of pain, and they tell me, I hate that my partner has a secret life and I feel left out and I just don't understand why my partner spends all this time doing this thing. And when I compare myself to porn, I feel inadequate. And you know, it's really hard to trust my partner knowing that he's got this secret life out there. So I hear about this all the time. Sometimes when people hear me talk about porn, they say, oh, you don't realize the pain that people are in. Believe me, I know the pain that people are in. It's partly how I make a living, talking to people who are in pain about pornography. And at the very same time, if you talk to consumers of pornography, and in the United States we have about 60 million adult consumers of this product, if you ask them what they say about pornography, it's a whole different story. Now, the number one thing that people who are consumers of pornography say is that it's an aid to masturbation. That's why people look at porn. When people look at porn and they're not masturbating, that's when I worry. I mean, what are you doing? Like, listening to the music? Is it the acting that's got you riveted? Because if you just want to watch a movie, you know, as long as Lawrence of Arabia is available, it's a better choice. So what consumers say is that they use it to masturbate. Very, very, very few people look at porn, and it's not part of masturbating. What else do people who look at porn say? Well, they say that, you know, it seems like abundance. You know, in pornography, there's enough of everything that anybody wants. There's enough penises. There's enough time. There's enough privacy if the characters in a given movie want privacy, and not every movie is about privacy. But whatever it is that people want, there's enough time. There's enough no crying babies. There's enough no teenagers banging on the door. There's enough breasts if you're into breasts, you know. So there's a lot of abundance, and that's a big contrast to the way that that some people's private sexual life really is, where there isn't a lot of abundance, where there's a lot of either inadequacy or stinginess or not enough time or not enough desire. You know, in porn, there's plenty of desire. Plenty of desire. What else do consumers say about porn? They say that it's no substitute for a good relationship. That's what people who are porn consumers say, that looking at porn is not a substitute for a good relationship. Now, some people who are porn consumers, what they say is that, unfortunately, a good sexual relationship is not available to me. And they have lots of reasons for that. Some of them reasonable, some of them not so reasonable. But what most porn consumers say is that looking at porn is not a substitute for a private sexual relationship with another person. Another thing that consumers say is that their partner's feelings about it can be very confusing. There's a lot of people who look at porn, and their experience is that it's this perfectly harmless activity. Whether it is or not, that's their own experience, that they're doing this perfectly harmless thing, and their partners are all revved up about it. And they say that's very confusing. They say that's very confusing. And one more thing that porn consumers generally say, they're different from cigarette smokers. How? I'll tell you how. If you talk to most cigarette smokers and you say, tell me something, you've been smoking cigarettes for 25 years. Do you think I ought to start smoking cigarettes? Most smokers will say, no, don't do that. Kid, don't do that. But if you ask most porn consumers, hey, I see that you consume porn two or three times a week, two or three times a day, two or three times an hour, whatever it is, you know. I notice that, you know, you consume porn two or three times a week. Do you think that maybe I should stay away from this product, this consumer product, if it's another adult? Most porn consumers would say, it's fine, go ahead, knock yourself out. So what most porn consumers say is that they're not like cigarette smokers, or to put it another way, that the product that they're using is not like cigarettes. Okay. We as a society could be a lot more curious than we actually are about the contrast between the pain that people are in about porn on the one hand and how many consumers say, it's okay by me. If we thought more about that contrast, we might learn a few things. But we don't. So here we are, awash in porn. I don't know anybody who would disagree with that. This is a culture that is awash in porn. 24/7 porn, any kind of porn you want. Porn featuring goats, porn featuring blondes, porn featuring gentlemen wearing hats, any kind of porn you like. Sometimes all three in the same movie. Any kind of porn you want. And it would be nice, since porn is such a dominant product in the marketplace, it would be nice if our culture and consumers' partners had more porn literacy. Now, if you've been around for a while, you know the expression media literacy. We've been talking about media literacy for a long time, that people need to be more literate consumers of the media products that they consume. They need to understand a little bit more about how those products are made, what are the circumstances, what kinds of choices are made. When I talk to college kids and I say, you know, there's an actual human being who decides what picture goes on the cover of a DVD or what picture goes on the cover of a video game, they're astonished. They say, wait, a person actually makes that decision? I say, oh yeah, you know, there's a person who makes a decision about what the title of a music album is going to be. They're amazed. They forget. Consumers, we all forget that media are created. It's not like George Washington bequeathed them to us, right? So we need more porn literacy. We need to understand more about the product that we're consuming. For example, is pornography real? Is pornography real? Unfortunately, a lot of people think that porn is a documentary. I have to inform people that porn is not a documentary. Porn is like a made-up thing. That doesn't make it bad, but it is a made-up thing. And there's a difference between a made-up thing and a documentary. And that's true whether the subject of the made-up thing and the documentary is tennis or the Civil War or anything else. It's really important to understand, whatever the topic is, are you looking at something real or are you looking at something made up? And we need to make sure that all consumers, especially young people, understand that the product that they're looking at, it may seem real, but it's not. It's made up. It's got acting. It's got lighting. It's got editing. It's got all this stuff that goes on off camera that the viewer doesn't look at. And frequently, it's many takes that are stitched together so that the consumer thinks, oh, what I'm looking at for 18 minutes actually took place all at once over 18 minutes. And that's not the way that any media product works. It's not the way that any movie works, and it's certainly not the way that pornography works. So there's a lot of ways that we could be talking about pornography to make sure that consumers are literate about it. How does your partner feel about it? And why do you watch it? I think that we should be asking people who play golf, why do you play golf? Why do you get so excited about a sport that has so much passion that you have to hold the crowd back with a piece of string? I know people are real passionate about golf. I don't play golf. I ask people, why do you like to play golf? I get a lot of interesting answers. I learn a lot about the people and I learn a lot about golf. So people who watch porn, particularly if their partner is upset about it, they should be asking themselves, well, why do I watch it? Not that people have to justify it, but it would be nice for people to understand themselves better around this product. And some people are using the consumption of porn as a form of medication. Now, that's what we do in America. We use products to medicate our feelings. Sometimes the product is alcohol. Sometimes the product is TV. Sometimes the product is eBay. Sometimes the product is Facebook. A lot of people, they get depressed, they go to Facebook. So porn is just one more product that some people use to medicate their anxiety, to medicate their depression, to medicate their loneliness. And that's not about the porn, that's about the people and the people's feelings. So the most important thing that I think we need to remember about porn is that real sex doesn't feel like porn looks. That is not an indictment of porn. That is not an indictment of porn. It simply is a statement about what are you looking at when you're looking at porn. And when you're looking at porn, you're looking at a product that is designed that is designed to make you feel certain feelings, and it's real good at that. I mean, good porn is real good about that, at that. And porn is designed to evoke a certain state in the viewer. Nothing wrong with that, but that's the truth of it. And if people think that, oh, when I go to have sex with my partner, I ought to be able to feel the way the characters in the porn film feel, that's a mistake. And that's not a mistake about porn. That's a mistake about people. It would be like imagining that when you watched the Super Bowl, that when you look at the way that the players seem to feel when they're in the Super Bowl, that you ought to be able to feel that same way when you play touch football in the backyard. And it just doesn't work like that. And people get real disappointed. People say, what's wrong with me that I don't feel that way? And the answer is, well, you know, you're not in the NFL. And the thing about porn is that it's very unusual bodies. They're not your average body. Can we all agree on this? It's not your average body. Porn features unusual bodies in unusual situations doing unusual things. Nothing wrong with that. But for people who don't know a lot about sex, when they watch these unusual bodies in these unusual situations doing these unusual things, some people think, how come my life isn't like that? And the answer is because your life is real life and porn is made up. But some people don't realize that. Now, the truth is, porn is a repository of our culture's feelings about sexuality. Porn's a repository of human curiosity about sex, human fear about sex. And this is true for all the porn that's ever been made in the last 10,000 years. In the last 10,000 years, there's been a lot of porn. We didn't invent porn here in the U.S. 20 years ago. And Hugh Hefner didn't invent porn in the 50s with Playboy. So human beings have been cranking out porn forever. And the porn is always about the same stuff. It's about whatever people fantasize about, and it's about whatever people are curious about, and it's about whatever people are afraid of. That's what porn has always been about. That's what porn will always be about. Nothing wrong with that, but that's the way it is. Now, some people, they look at porn and they say that the content of porn is problematic. It's disgusting, or it's demeaning, or it's this, or it's that. Porn is just a reflection of how human beings feel about sexuality. If you don't like the way that human beings feel about sexuality, don't blame porn. That's like shooting the messenger. Don't blame porn if people are wildly enthusiastic fantasizing about sex with their siblings or sex with their parents or sex with their children. That's human beings for you. And porn didn't invent that. Porn didn't invent that. Human beings love sexual fantasies involving coercion. Porn didn't invent the fact that people love fantasizing about that. People, for the most part, people don't want coercion in their real sex lives, but people love fantasizing about coercion in sex. And so porn is going to reflect that. Don't blame porn. Porn's just the messenger. Now, some people complain that porn has become de facto sex education for a whole generation of young people. And that's factually true, and it's very troubling. The answer to that is not, let's take away the porn. The answer to that is, can we please have some real sex education? Please? It's crazy that you can go through school and have what is called sex education, and there's no mention of the clitoris, there's no mention of pleasure, there's no mention of anything that's recognizable as sexuality. What sex education in American schools is typically about is don't do this, don't do that, and for God's sake, don't even think about that. Sex is and the message in sex education in America is typically sex is a beautiful, wonderful thing that you should never do until you're about 40. Or to put it another way, sex is dirty and ugly, and you should save it for someone you love. So that's a real common message in American sex education. And it is troubling that so many young people are learning about sex through pornography. everybody who's upset about that, everybody who's concerned about that should be marching to the school board, to their local school board, and saying, can we please have some more serious sex education so that kids understand that if you look at this adult product, it's not a documentary. And by the way, if people are going to complain that they don't like porn as sex education, while you're in the neighborhood, you should also be complaining about the fashion industry, music industry, church, and all the other agencies in society that are sex educating our kids ineptly. It's not only porn. It's not only porn. When you get a church-sponsored program that says boys are like boys and men are like this and girls and women are like that, and their two sexualities are completely different, and what it's all about is that females need to keep males off of them because, you know, males are all predatory sexually. When you get a program like that, that's as bad a sex educator as Butt Busters 3 or whatever porn you're watching. So back to the question, what do you suppose would happen if the country were flooded with free porn? Back to the question. Well, in 2000, that's what actually happened. And now we know. We could learn so much from studying what actually happened in the last 16 years in American culture. Not that that's the only thing that happened in the last 16 years, but it is kind of a showstopper. I mean, it's a really big deal. I mean, some other things happened in the last 16 years. I hear the Chicago Cubs did something or other. But what the country has done instead is collapse into a moral panic, another moral panic about sex. This one's a porn panic. Every 10 years or so, there's another moral panic about sexuality in the United States. Some crusade with overstated danger, overstated fear, the media gets on board, public figures get on board, and all of a sudden everybody believes that there's this terrible threat that we have to mobilize against. And people who we might call moral entrepreneurs, they whip up public passion about a threat that is blown way out of proportion. So and the result is that people don't want to hear about the facts. My friend David Lay was famously on Katie Kirk, and you've heard of Katie Kirk, right? Not my friend David Lay, but Katie Kirk. And he was talking about some statistics, and she famously said, "I'm so tired of statistics. Can't we use our common sense?" That's just a horrible thing to say. I mean, if you want to use your common sense, then it's perfectly obvious that the earth is flat. Perfectly. I mean, look at this floor right here. It's totally obvious if you use your common sense that the earth is flat. Common sense is not a substitute for science. So here are some previous moral panics about sexuality. And if you've lived a while, you've lived through some of these. You remember about in the 80s, people were saying, oh, there's all these snuff films where people are getting murdered on camera. Never happened. There's never one ever been made. People, about 15 years ago, there was a new drug that young people could get inoculated for against HPV, which could cause infertility and some other problems. A wonder drug, a fantastic drug. Under the brand name Gardasil now. And there were some people who actually said, oh, we shouldn't give this this medication to young people because they might feel that they're so protected that they might run out and go have sex. So I could just imagine, you know, like, what are they thinking? Like, well, there's some 12-year-old Jennifer who says, oh, Jason, I'm sorry, I'd love to have sex with you, but I might get HPV, so we can't. But wait. I'm going to get this Gardasil injection, and then I won't get HPV. Come on, let's do it. That just makes no sense at all. Over the years, there have been moral panics about rock and roll. You know, back in the 50s, there were record burnings, because rock and roll was so dangerous. Salem witch trials, you know, hundreds of years ago. Very few of you were alive back then. That's another example of moral panic. Now, every new technology in Western culture is adapted for sexual purposes as soon as possible. That's just the way it is. The printing press, a great thing, right? People started to worry, what if we start distributing naughty literature? Oh, big problem. And then when rubber was first invented, artificial rubber, back in the 1850s by Charles Goodyear, immediately adapted to the purpose of condoms. A fabulous thing, right? America's first female physician, Elizabeth Blackwell, famously, totally against these newfangled rubber condoms because it would encourage prostitution. So there's a concern about how a new product, a new technology is being adapted to sexual purposes. People were concerned about the electrification of downtowns around 1900, 1905, because now people could go downtown and meet each other unescorted, unchaperoned. And they were afraid about what would happen when people went down there unchaperoned. So people were concerned about the sexual application of downtown electrification. Same thing with cars. Same thing with photography. You know, when photography was first invented in the 19th century, one of the very first uses of photography was that women on the home front would take racy photos of themselves and send them to their sweethearts who were going off to fight in the Civil War. The federal government didn't like this at all, but there was the immediate sexual application of a new technology. And we already know what's happened with smartphones. And by the way, does anybody know that virtual reality is on its way? And people are not thinking so much about virtual reality. Oh, good, it'll help me shop at Safeway. No. People are thinking virtual reality. I get to see Scarlett Johansson without her clothes. Fantastic. So whenever there's a disruptive technology, and it's great to speak in Silicon Valley because we all know disruptive technology. And of course, the internet is a disruptive technology and broadband certainly a disruptive technology. So when a society receives a new disruptive technology, and by definition, society is never ready for it. If society was ready for it, it wouldn't be a disruptive technology, right? So when a society is sitting around drinking coffee, minding its own business, and a new disruptive technology is dropped into that society, there are two challenges. Not one, there are two challenges. And the two challenges are, one, how to deal with the new technology, and two, how to deal with the new sexual applications of this new technology. So it's not enough to be dealing with broadband internet, which is a huge challenge. No, society at the very same time has to deal with the sexual application of broadband internet. And so we get people who need tech support, right? Hold on, I'm going to call tech support. The new internet porn, the high-speed, high-quality internet porn that was dropped into America's homes in the year 2000 and in subsequent years, America had to deal with that before it had really come to grips with this brand-new internet thing in the first place. And a lot of the problems that America is grappling with around broadband pornography is really problems that America has about dealing with broadband in general. And pornography is taking more than its share of the blame and the criticism for what is happening in society around this new technology. And of course, if you go back to the year 2000, when broadband brought porn into everybody's home, if you go back to 2000, many of you were already alive at that point, America was a very sexually confused place. Very sexually confused place. Oral sex, still illegal in a lot of places. Gays couldn't serve in the military. There were lots and lots of bills in Congress attempting to censor the internet. I was involved in a number of cases. The state of Arizona passed a law prohibiting anyone from sending material over the internet into Arizona that would be inappropriate for children. They actually passed that law. Michigan did too. They tried to do it in New York also. Now, of course, those of us who have any understanding of the internet realize that that's completely crazy. But back then, people still dealing with this newfangled thing of the internet. And of course, one of the main things that people were concerned about back in 2000 was about sex. Back in 2000, people right here in San Francisco, the police were going after adult bookstores and adult video stores. Strip clubs were under attack. Perfectly lovely swing scene in Phoenix, Arizona, completely shut down as a part of a crusade against public health crisis. Anybody remember Janet Jackson's nipple? Am I the only one? One person. Okay. Let me tell the rest of you. In 2004, during the Super Bowl halftime show, does this ring a bell now for anybody? Good. Okay. In 2004, during the Super Bowl halftime, Janet Jackson Justin Timberlake, they're on stage and they're supposedly singing, I guess. They're doing what they're doing, and at the climax of the show, you know, he reveals Janet Jackson's nipple, and the whole world just sort of completely came to a standstill. And I mean, I have a lot of complaints about that because the lighting was very poor. But it was the most downloaded moment on the internet ever up to that point. And so this is the United States when this whole broadband porn thing came on. Sexually, it was a very disturbed. It was the height of abstinence-only sex education, where federally mandated sex education was that young people had to be taught. Schools didn't have a choice. Had to be taught that the only appropriate way for two people to be sexual is if they were married and monogamous. That was taught in schools, a federal mandate. So when broadband was dropped into America 16 years ago, it was not a sexually healthy place. And how America dealt with porn, you know, was just part of that that unhealthy situation. Here's a picture. If you go to the internet and you type in, if you go to Google and you type in Janet Jackson nipple Super Bowl, you get thousands of pictures. This is the G-rated version, for which I apologize. Now, back in the 1970s, let's go backwards. Back in the 1970s, when Roe v. Wade was decided, a lot of people who were sexually very conservative got very upset about this. This is factual. This is not my opinion. There was a big meeting in Colorado. All of the really important people in the religious right got together and said, what are we going to do about this? It's a terrible thing. What are we going to do? And one of the things that they decided was that they were going to try and get elected to as many school boards in the United States as possible. And they succeeded wildly at this. This was a wildly successful strategy. There were a whole series of things that that the religious right attempted to implement in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s about sexuality. And before Roe v. Wade, you know, the 50s and the 60s, and masturbation was still talked about in religious communities as being sinful. Personally, I think if God didn't want us to masturbate, he wouldn't have made our arms quite so long. But I digress. For many, many years, masturbation was considered sinful, which was a misreading of the Bible, because the Bible talks about Onan spilling his seed. Onan was not masturbating. Onan was actually was supposed to impregnate his dead brother's widow, right? So that she could raise that child as her own. Leveret marriage, it's called. She could raise the child as her own. The child would inherit the property because a woman couldn't inherit property. And so when Onan spilled his seed on the ground and refused to impregnate his dead brother's widow, he was actually committing real estate fraud. And that's why God struck him dead. Well, you could look it up. So masturbation. So there was a willful mistranslation of this. Now a lot of people think the Bible is written in English. I got to tell you, it was not. When the Bible was finally translated into English, which took a long time, this was mistranslated. And so today, to this very day, onanism is a synonym for masturbation. So for a long time, masturbation was considered a sin. But as we got through the swinging 60s and the 70s and then into the 80s, and so masturbation stopped being considered quite so sinful. People started to think, you know, give me a break. So what happened was the critique of pornography, which used to be, well, it's immoral because it's tied to masturbation, right? The critique for decades of masturbation was, it's immoral, it's bad for the user. That critique got changed to, it's a public health menace. The religious right meticulously changed this narrative from pornography is immoral to pornography is a public health menace. It's dangerous for everybody. It's dangerous for the user. It's dangerous for the user's marriage. It's dangerous for the user's family. It's dangerous for kids. It's dangerous for the whole community. It causes violence, and so it's dangerous for everybody. It is bad for women. It's dangerous that way. So the critique changed. And the important thing about that is that once the critique changed and pornography, and one story about pornography was that it was dangerous for everyone, that invited a whole new bunch of stakeholders. You know, when Playboy came out in the 50s, it was considered immoral, and the only people really who spoke out against it, the primary group of people who spoke out against it, were the immorality people, which is to say, organized religion. By the time broadband brought porn into everyone's home, it wasn't only religious people who got to object to it. It was a whole new group of people. People against trafficking, people against sex abuse, people against sex work, people against child molestation, people against porn addiction. So suddenly, there were a whole new group of people who got to be real passionate about opposing pornography, whether they knew anything about it or not. And that's the situation that we have today. People don't so much limit themselves when they talk about porn. When they criticize porn, people don't so much limit themselves to it's bad for the users. People say it's bad for the community. It's bad for all women. It causes all this violence. It does all these terrible things. And so suddenly people, anti-trafficking people, and of course trafficking is a terrible thing, right? But people who are against trafficking, suddenly they get a seat at the public policy table opposing pornography. And there's a huge amount of momentum. You've seen it yourself in the last 5 years. Trafficking people, I mean the anti-trafficking people, their voice is getting louder and louder and louder, and they have opinions about pornography. A lot of people do. And strangely enough, the 60 million consumers of this product still don't have a seat at the public policy table. So I'm going to ask you one more time, what did happen when America was flooded with free porn 24/7, what did happen? Well, here's a schematic. Here's a schematic. It starts in the year 2000, goes all the way up to 2015. Now, this is not my opinion. These are data taken from the FBI, the Centers for Disease Control, and the Crimes Against Children Research Center. Very simple. It has to be simple because I did it on my own computer. So over the last 16 years, as the availability of porn has gone up, that's a fact. What has happened to the rate of sexual assault in the United States? It's gone down. What has happened to the rate of divorce in the United States? It's gone down. What has happened to the rate of child sexual exploitation? It's gone down. Now, I'm too much of a social scientist to say this proves that the more porn you have, the less of these other things you have. No, no, no. But I could observe the correlation just like you can. That in the last 16 years, the amount of porn has gone up, the amount of divorce has gone down. I'm not saying that one causes the other, but these are two facts that nobody can challenge. They're both facts. Same thing with the rates of sexual violence in the United States. The rate of sexual violence in the United States has been going down steadily for the last 16 years. That's a fact. It's not my opinion, that's a fact. And that's happening at the exact same time that pornography is getting more common, more common, more common, and more people are using it, more people are using it, more people are using it. So to me, this suggests that all this pornography is not causing a lot of divorce, causing more divorce. It's not causing more sexual violence. It's not causing more sexual child molestation. Now, of course, child molestation is a bad thing. Sexual assault is a bad thing. Nobody likes divorce. But these things are not increasing as we get more porn. So anyone who's talking about we have to get rid of porn because it causes these things, they're either uninformed or they're, shall we say, not aligned with the facts. And why they're doing that, who knows. So just a couple of common myths about form, about porn. We'll stop in a few minutes and take some questions. Just a couple of common myths. It's all violent. Gail Dines, an anti-porn activist, she claims that all porn is brutality and horrifying violence. I don't know what kind of porn Gail Dines watches, but apparently she's watching some very exotic stuff. Most porn on the internet shows happy, smiling people doing happy, smiling things. You know, the kind of things that you used to do when you were first, like, only married a year or two? Most, I can say that because I'm a marriage counselor. But seriously, most porn is not violent for a very simple reason. Most people don't want to watch violent porn. If most people wanted to watch violent porn, there'd be lots and lots and lots of violent porn. Now, it's true. Some people like to watch it. Some people like to fantasize about sexual violence. But to say that all or even most porn is violent is just simply misinformed. And people who make a living on the lecture circuit trying to scare the hell out of people about all this incredibly violent porn, they're either misinformed or they're lying. I don't know which. I'm sure that for some people it's one, for some people it's the other. Another thing that we hear is that actresses are frequently trafficked into porn. That is so not true. If you go down to LA where they make porn, young women are like lined up around the block hoping for the opportunity to get into porn. The porn producers don't have to drag anybody into the industry. People are begging to be in the industry. So no, there's virtually no trafficking when it comes to making porn. Another common myth about porn is that it leads to sex problems like erectile dysfunction. This is this is something that I deal with on a weekly basis, erectile dysfunction. Not my own, I mean my patients. And I can tell you what causes erectile dysfunction. If we have a couple of hours, I'll be happy to talk to you all about it. But watching porn does not cause erection problems. Watching porn does not diminish people's sexual desire for their partner. There are lots of other things that cause erection problems and lots of other things that diminish people's sexual interest in their partners. And while that's happening, some of those people are watching porn. But watching porn is not what causes erection problems or diminished desire. And when I hear people like Melissa Farley or Gail Dines talk about how porn is just this horrifying brutality and this horrifying violence and, you know, stuff that would just make you sick to watch. And when they say that, you know, all porn is like that, I wonder whose husbands and brothers and sons and fathers do they think is watching it? If you yourself think that most or all porn is horrifying violence, exactly who do you think is watching it? Is your husband or is your son? Is your dad is watching that horrifying brutality? And if not, you know, who do you think is watching it? So I don't know who the anti-porn activists hang out with, but they describe a world of horrifying coercion and violence that fortunately doesn't exist. So what should concern us? The thing that we really should be concerned about is that young people are looking at this adult product. It's a product made for adults. They're consuming a product made for adults without enough education to realize what exactly they're looking at. They're looking at acting. They're looking at acting. And they're looking at people pretending in a playful way to push each other, like a lot of people do in real life. Like, listen, tonight, honey, when we get into bed, you better not expect that I'm going to kiss you. Wink, wink, wink. You know, and the game is on. That's what a lot of people do. The technical word for that is teasing. A lot of people do that. And you see it in porn frequently, where one person is pretending to force the other person to do something that they really want to do, and everybody has a good time. Young people don't know enough about sex to realize that that's what they're looking at. They don't realize they're looking at games. They think they're looking at real life. So it's absolutely essential that we say to young people the equivalent of, look, this product is not made for you. It's made for grown-ups, and I don't want you to watch it. However, you do a whole bunch of stuff that I don't want you to do. So if you're going to watch this porn thing, which I don't want you to do, if you're going to watch this porn thing, there's some stuff that you need to understand. Parents need to talk to their kids about the porn that kids are watching. Now, I am totally sympathetic about how much parents do not want to talk to their kids about porn. I'm totally sympathetic about that. Nobody would want that to be the first conversation that they have with their kids about sex. And so what that means is that parents need to talk to their kids about sex so that they can sit down and have a conversation with their kids about porn and say, let me tell you about the differences between porn and real life sex, and let me tell you about why I don't want you to watch porn in the first place. But if you do, let me tell you some stuff that you need to know. That conversation is hard enough if you already have a relationship with a kid where you talk about sex. If you don't have a relationship with a kid where you talk about sex, that conversation is infinitely harder. So when people complain to me about porn, you know, gives kids the wrong ideas about sex, I say, well, where do you suppose they ought to get the right ideas? Where do you suppose they should get the right ideas? And that's what a lot of adults really object to about porn, that it is demanding that they talk to their kids about sex, and a lot of parents simply don't want to do that. And I'm very sympathetic about that, but that's your responsibility. It's your responsibility to teach your kid about how to take care of their teeth. It's your responsibility to teach their kids about how to treat people who they don't like, and a million other things. And one of the things that it's your responsibility to do is talk to your kids about sex, and that includes talking about porn. And it's our responsibility to teach kids that, you know, porn leaves a lot of stuff out. In fact, it leaves stuff out that some people think is the whole point of sex. The kissing, the laughing, the fooling around, the going slow, the hugging. And I'm not saying that porn should say those things, but it doesn't. And the fact that it leaves those things out, it mostly leaves these things out because they are very non-visual, non-cinematic. I mean, when was the last time you watched people hug for 8 minutes? I mean, it is the most boring thing in the world. It's like watching paint dry. Oh, there they are hugging. Yeah, and oh, she's got her arm on his shoulder. Yeah, whoa. And oh, what is he doing? Oh, he's tilting his head. Oh, amazing. It's really boring to watch people hug. That's why you don't see it in porn. You don't see birth control being discussed in porn. You don't see anything being discussed in porn because it's boring to watch people talk unless they're talking about you. So that's what porn leaves out. And that's why we so much need to talk to kids about sex and porn. And we need to remind them that there's acting involved. They're watching paid people, people who would not be doing this if they were not getting paid. And they're watching people follow a script, unlike in real life. They're acting. They talk about what they're doing ahead of time. And it's predictable, unlike real sex, which the whole point of it is that it should be non-predictable. So the future of porn, we're looking at a lot of amateur productions. If you go to Reddit or a lot of the other social media sites, we're seeing more and more amateur porn because people want to see what their neighbors might look like having sex. My thing about amateur porn, some people, they should clean up the living room before they shoot amateur porn. That's all I'm saying. And of course, virtual reality is coming too. And again, the most important thing to remember about porn, real sex does not feel like porn looks. So that's the key points for my new book, His Porn, Her Pain, which of course is for sale over there. And we're going to take a deep breath. We're going to open the door to let some air in here, and then I'll be happy to answer your questions. Thank you very much.
Okay, so if anyone has any cards, you'd write down the questions on the cards and hand them up. Well, while that's coming up, I'll ask a question.
Eric, do you have a question?
Yeah. I see statistics that the 20-somethings are having less sex than the 40-somethings had when they were that age.
Uh-huh.
Is that affected by porn? Is that a result of worrying about being perfect in porn or whatever?
That's a great question, which I'm glad to answer. And the question is, if 20-somethings are having less sex than 40-somethings, if 20-somethings are having less sex than 40-somethings, what does that have to do with porn? I'll tell you what I think it has to do with. I think what it has to do with is the internet and digital life in general. Digital life, which let's just, for simplicity's sake, say that's smartphones plus the internet. That's digital life, right? Smartphones plus the internet. Real life cannot compete with digital life. Real life cannot compete with the limitless world that is available in our pockets and our screens. And so when you get, if you go out in public, and I know you've seen the exact same thing that I have, which is you see a bunch of high school kids or a bunch of college kids sitting around, and there'll be three or four of them, let's say three or four young people sitting around. One person is talking, one person is listening, maybe, and the other two people, they're looking at their phones. And they take turns. They go around, they take turns. You know, you talk now, and maybe later you look at your cell phone. You listen now, and later you look at your phones, check your email, whatever it is. And what's happening is that what young people have learned is that they can either listen to one person and get to know one person and have the attention of one person, or they can have the entire world at their fingertips. And for those of us who are my age, we remember before the internet, and we remember this interesting thing called conversation. We remember this interesting thing called putting your hand on somebody's shoulder and talking and looking in their eyes. But young people, they don't have that experience. So young people think that what's normal is digital life, mediated life. And so what they're used to doing is getting an enormous amount of stimulation, way more stimulation in a day than I ever had when I was 20 years old. Way more stimulation in a given day, primarily from digital sources. And real life can't compete with that. And sex with one person where for 25 minutes you're not looking at a screen, for some young people is terrifying, and for some young people it's just so wildly unfamiliar they just don't know what to do with it. And for some young people it's just boring. And so I think that accounts for whatever hesitation young people have about sex right now, which is even after they try it. You know, they try it. What do you get for your 25 minutes? You get one person. Thank you very much. And that's all you get. You get one person for 25 minutes. Whereas the second it's over, you check your email, you got the entire world at your fingertips. And I think it's not pornography. Pornography is just a subset of that issue. The issue is digital life. And until people realize that that face-to-face personal contact with another human being has something to offer that digital life doesn't have to offer, that's just going to get more and more like that. So that's my long answer to your very excellent question, Eric.
Okay, we have another question here. Is porn desensitizing in any way?
Well, there's a lot of funny answers to that, but the serious answer is I think when you do anything over and over and over and over and over and over again, there is a habituating effect. And that's true about watching five college football games every Saturday for 10 weeks. And that's true about going to your same restaurant week after week after week after week. People get habituated. And when people get habituated, the human brain craves novelty. So if we do stuff where we get habituated, we have to, the brain demands that we sneak in something unfamiliar in that, if it's at all possible. So I think what's true is that when people look at porn, they may get habituated in pretty much the same way that people get habituated to whatever it is that they do over and over and over and over and over and over again. And I think for some people, that's a bigger problem than it is for other people. I think for some people, they're able to contain that in some sort of a mental box. And for other people, they're less able to keep that contained.
I'm going to combine two questions here. Combine them. The first is, what ages does porn enter into the developmental mind in a child's life, and does it differ between boys and girls? And the other question that's related somewhat is the impact of porn more significant on youth because of brain plasticity?
Well, those are really two different questions. I caught you. Let's see if I can give you less than a 3-hour answer to that. Well, let's keep in mind that porn is not the only input on young people's sexual development, right? When you're bathing a 2-year-old and you say, oh, what a wonderful shoulder you have. Oh, what a wonderful belly you have. Oh, what a wonderful kneecap you have. You know, that's sex education. That's sex education too. And when we refuse to acknowledge kids' sexuality, that's sex education. And when kids go to the store with their own money and buy clothes that we think are too sexy, that's sex education too. And music and what they learn in church and everything else, there's all these inputs into their sexuality. Porn is not the only input. It's a significant input, but it's not the only input. And partly the impact of porn on a 10-year-old, again, I am not in favor of 10-year-olds looking at porn, right? But partly the impact of porn on a 10-year-old's mind is going to depend a lot on what the context is. Have they learned that sex is a bad thing? Have they learned that boys are dangerous? Have they learned that God hates sex? Have they learned that sex is going to kill them? Have they learned that their sexual fantasies are shameful or evil? So if the context for young people consuming porn is a lot of this emotional violence, if you will, a lot of this negativity, a lot of this sex is bad, sex is bad, sex is bad, save it for somebody you love, sex is bad, then I think that when they watch porn, it's going to affect them differently than if they don't have nightmares about the fact that I looked at porn and therefore I'm a bad person, or I looked at porn and therefore God hates me.
I'm going to try again to combine some here. We'll see how far I get. There are a series of questions involving what percentage of consumers, of porn consumers, are female. Mm-hmm. And, you know, is it really a product for males? Is it what's the feminist position on this? And how does this affect gender stereotypes also?
This is why you need me to give a 7-hour lecture. Let me talk about gender. That's a great set of questions, and you did a great job putting all these questions together that I can't answer. But let's talk about gender stereotypes for a second. Again, if you talk to an anti-porn activist who says, or just a lay person who says, what porn is about women servicing men. What porn is about men, women pleasing men, and women's needs don't count. What porn are these people watching? I mean, there's a lot of porn. There's a huge amount of porn out there about men pleasuring women. because a lot of people enjoy watching that. Not for some politically positive reason. It's a consumer product like Chevrolet's, you know. There's a reason that Chevrolet's don't have 14 cup holders because consumers don't want them. So if you look at a lot of porn, what you see, not that porn is real life. We've already established that. But if you look at a lot of porn, what do you see? You see a lot of women who have sexual desire. You see a lot of women who have sexual passion. You see a lot of women having orgasms. You see a lot of women whose clitorises are being stimulated. Which is, you see a lot of women whose characters, you see a lot of characters who accept their bodies. You see a lot of women who are enthusiastic about being sexual. Now, this is not the stereotype of women in Western culture, right? But this is what you see in porn. Now, to me, it's great that there is this image of women out in the culture. And it's places not just in porn. You can see these images in other places too. But, you know, the idea that what porn is all about is women getting on their knees and pleasuring men, I mean, there's some of that, sure. But, you know, there's nothing wrong with that either. But there's tons of porn, and I mean tons. I don't mean it's a niche market. It is not a niche market to show women being sexually desirous and passionate and enthusiastic and satisfied. That's not a niche market. That's called porn. So the idea that porn, you know, contributes to the stereotyping of the genders. I mean, every medium has to stereotype everybody involved. I mean, there's the Irish person who drinks too much. There's the Italian who loves to cook, et cetera, et cetera. That's the way that the media operate. But to say, to single out porn and to say that there's this gender stereotyping going on, that, you know, male sexuality somehow exploits women, that's a terribly anti-feminist position. It's a terribly anti-feminist position to suggest that women who want to have oral sex, that somehow that's degrading to the woman. That's a terribly unfeminist position.
Here we have one. Can you please touch on why characterizations of porn addiction are wrong, given that you do not think that porn can be addicted? And it says, i.e., the movie Shame.
Well, porn addiction was invented a few years ago, and it was invented by the people who brought you sex addiction in the 1980s. And somehow there's this idea that there are people who look at porn and they lose control of themselves and porn takes over, that there's something special about this product that addicts people. And that is so disrespectful to real addiction. You know, if you ever have the misfortune to hang around with somebody who's trying to become not addicted to heroin or morphine or alcohol or OxyContin, if you ever observe what it's like to go through withdrawal from those substances, it is hell. People shake, they vomit, they hallucinate, they can't sleep, they tremble. It's just the most awful thing in the world. You'll never forget it if you ever see it. That's what real addiction looks like when people are trying to get off of the substance that they're addicted to. If you take porn away from somebody who watches a lot of porn, you know what happens? They get crabby. So that's my first clue. That's my first clue that whatever we mean by addiction, if we mean something that's just like heroin and morphine and alcohol and all that, porn doesn't work like that. That's my first observation on that. My second observation on that is that when people try and stop looking at porn, they generally stop trying to masturbate. And when people stop masturbating, if they've been masturbating, let's say, every day for 10 years, and then they stop masturbating, they get really crabby. They get really crabby. And that's totally understandable. What I think is really true is that some people get really involved with porn, and they have lives of loneliness, or they have lives of isolation, or they have lives of feeling powerless. They have lives where they either don't have the tools to create a good sexual relationship with somebody, or they're with a person who's not interested in a really satisfying sexual relationship with them. And so they wind up getting involved with porn maybe more than they intended to, but they're really involved in it. Are they addicted? Well, if what you mean by addicted is their body changes its ability to metabolize that substance, no, there's absolutely no evidence of that. And the last thing I want to say about that to support that is that, you know, there are people who are saying, you know, when people look at porn, their brain lights up. Yeah, it's again, I worry about the people who look at porn and their brain doesn't light up, you know, but their brain lights up and they say, and it lights up in the exact same way that the brain lights up when people use heroin. Yeah, that's accurate. It lights up when you look at porn, your brain lights up in the exact same way that it lights up when you cuddle your grandchildren or you look at a sunset. So the idea that your brain lights up when you look at porn the same way it lights up when you look at heroin, and that proves that it's addictive just like heroin, that's just silly. Of course the brain lights up. The brain is a pleasure center. We have evolved that way, and your brain registers pleasure, whether it's cuddling your grandchild or looking at a sunset or, you know, finding out they finally got rid of Colin Kaepernick or, you know, whatever it is, right? Whatever gives you pleasure, your brain's going to light up. And of course, when you look at porn, you have pleasure. If you don't, that's when I worry that you're looking at porn. So, Eric, these people are a great audience. I hate to say goodbye.
Okay, our gratitude to Dr. Klein for being with us today. We're also grateful to our audience here as well as those listening to the recording. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 113th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.